the program. We look forward to you joining us for the Arts Magazine at 2 p.m. right here over WBAI. Visit us online at WBAI.org. It's 1 o'clock. Stay tuned for The Positive Mind with Armand DeMille.
Armand DeMille with you with The Positive Mind here on WBAI 99.5 FM on your dial. Bringing you ideas, concepts, guests to help you lead a more positively minded life. And the more and more informed we get, the more and more complex the world gets. And simpler at the same time. It thrills me to hear our president say we're going to give science its proper place. But there's always a tendency with science to get a little too scientific. There's always a tendency with science to try to reduce everything to impulses, drives, hormones, and things like that, which they may all be, but, you know, it sometimes leaves out things like human emotion. Maybe it doesn't leave it out completely, but maybe it helps, it overshadows it a bit. The reason I bring this to you today is today we're doing a program about male sexuality, and my guest by telephone is Dr. Michael Bader, B-A-D-E-R, who wrote a book about male sexuality. He said why women don't understand it and men don't either. And Dr. Bader, Michael, has got an approach that he talks about some of the things that I was trained in, some of the things that I believe in. And I thought we should take a close look at this today because I think it's very valuable. Michael, are you with us?
I sure am.
Oh, it works. I love it when it works. So, I talk about the tendency to scientize, to make it all a matter of hormones and drives And it just seems to be the push becomes more and more to explain everything in terms of testosterone and estrogen and progesterone and dopamine and so on and so forth and oxytocin. And we now have these words to account for something of what we've always observed, but seems to be maybe missing some elements. Do you want to talk to that?
Yeah, I couldn't agree more with that. I was giving a talk a while ago, and a psychiatrist stood up. I was talking about sexual fantasies, and in particular the fantasy that many men have about younger women. And he stood up and he said, look, why do we need all this fancy psychology stuff? There's a simple reason why men are attracted to younger women. It has to do with evolution and the fact that younger women represent an opportunity for the man to sort of spread and reproduce his seed because she's fertile, and that's why men are attracted to younger women. And I said to him, I said, well, that's probably a factor there, but how would you explain a particular man, let's say Joe, who in the course of having sex with a younger woman likes to be, let's say, tied up, or likes to do it in a public place, or has some other particular fantasy about it that to him is very intense and very precious? How would you explain that with reference to an evolutionary urge? And of course he couldn't, because some of these explanations are necessary but not sufficient to account for the real lived experience of real human beings, in this case, in the bedroom. So I by no means think that the role of hormones and neuroscientific findings and evolution are not important. I think they are important, but I think they give us only the broadest context, and that for any individual to explain his or her behavior or feelings on the basis of that, I think really usually widely misses the mark.
And why do you think there's such a tendency to do it? I mean, we could get to why women or why people are trying to explain drives and chemistry and everything now, because there seems to be something about it that's, there's a deeper place we could go with it. Now, let's go to the moment of psychoanalytic thought, just because both of you and I were trained in that. And let's go down to fantasy. Let's just take something, for example, as simple as the woman's breast. Right? And men's attraction to women's breast and their fascination with it and what it means.
Yes.
Well, we have very good explanations that could come from science. We could talk about chemistry. We could talk about what we've inherited. We could talk about being able to provide our offspring. We could talk about all of that. But then the breast is such a symbol of so many things that come from early childhood with men.
Yes, and one of the things that it, I think it very often symbolizes has to do with the provision of care and nurturing, the idea that a man has that with such a woman, that she's very eager to give to him, has a lot to give, and therefore that he doesn't have to in any way feel frustrated or guilty or worried that he wants too much or he needs too much or he is too much for her. So that the fascination often, and some call it a fixation on the breast, often reflects the man's longing to have a woman be someone who has an endless supply of good things to give to him and enjoys the process of giving them.
A supply at least as big as his need, if not bigger.
Exactly.
Which
right.
is what it is. So the more needy you feel, you would say, the more needy a man is for the kind of nurturance that he derives from this, not just sexual nurturance, the more needy a man will be, the more he'll be attracted to probably the more abundant breast. The bigger the breast, the more it fascinates him. There's got to be a reason why so many women in the world went and got implants.
That's very, very true.
You know, I mean, they're all saying, here, I've got it for you now. You wanted this so desperately, here it is. Even if it's plastic, it's going to be okay by you. You're going to find it attractive.
And it's a measure of the man's need, but it's also a measure of the degree to which the man feels conflict or guilt or worry or anxiety about his need. So that the idea of a breast for a man is often something that reassures him against a worry that he wants and needs too much.
Okay, so let's take a look at men and their fantasies. Right? What about their sexual fantasies? You say sexual fantasies are a clear window into the core issues with which people struggle. Now, that's such a fascinating thing, because if you think about it, you would say almost every person I've ever counseled, and we have a sex therapist here, the Stephanie Dombra, who also does counseling with this, you could always find behind the sexual fantasy some kind of acting out of an early childhood struggle. It's almost always there. And one example I'll give, for example, is what I learned when I was working with some people who were acting out masochists. And they would talk about how if they felt physical pain while they had sex, it increased the amount of sensation they had. Therefore, it brought them closer to having orgasm. So therefore, the desire for pain was so that they could feel more. Now, that sounds pretty chemical, and it sounds pretty well, all right, that's pretty chemical, that's there's a good chemical. But then the question is, why don't you feel? What is it about you that didn't feel that we had to turn you on by giving you physical pain to make you feel?
That's very true. You know, there are a subgroup of people that experience pain as sort of enlivening them and counteracting feelings of deadness that they have. That's why some people cut, as well as, in this case, some people enjoy pain as a prelude to pleasure. But I'll have to say that I find probably the majority of people who will say they get aroused by masochistic scenarios, that there's a somewhat different dynamic that's going on. And it usually has something, although again, this is not by any means universal, but usually has to do with an attempt to overcome momentarily, just long enough to feel pleasure, something about a worry they have of hurting the other person, or a kind of guilty sense of responsibility for the other person that burdens them. You know, a lot of people, men and women in different ways, feel a great deal of concern about the internal states of their sexual partner. They want to please them. They feel responsible for making them happy. They feel guilty when they don't. And that dominates their waking life and also their sexual life. But those feelings really hold back our desire. They make it hard to get aroused when we're too worried about the other person and too responsible for their internal welfare. So part of what sexual fantasies do is they enable us, I think, to momentarily to overcome those obstacles. And in the domination fantasy, it's very clear. That is, I'm not hurting you. I can't hurt you. You're the active one in control, doing something to me. I'm not responsible for you or for your welfare. You're being utterly selfish, so I can be, without concern for your tender inner feelings or your sense of satisfaction.
Oh, interesting. And Dr. Michael Bader, B-A-D-E-R, the name of the book, this is really fascinating now, Male Sexuality. I'm sorry to interrupt, but let me take that just a step further with you.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
Are you saying that men and women both have a penchant inside them, as we all do as kids, nasty kids growing up? We have a little sadistic part of us, a streak. And some part of us believes that we would hurt our partner if we were allowed to be intimate, many of us. And those of us who believe that tend to be attracted to someone who is strong enough not to take our giving them pain. So you're saying, in effect, you know, that masochism may be in an attempt to control your own sadism.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think you hit it right on the head. I think that there are a couple of ways that we grow up, all of us, in some way, worried about hurting others. You know, you can look at it, as some do, as just having an aggressive little instinct in us, or you could think of it in another way. You could say that part of sexual arousal and pleasure at its best involves a person's ability to use the other person, do unto the other person, without worrying about the effect of your actions on the other person. I call it in my book healthy ruthlessness. And by that I mean that part of sexual excitement means that I can surrender to my own sensations, you might say, selfishly, without having to worry about their impact on you. Now, that isn't the be-all and end-all of all sexual excitement. Obviously, empathy and caring for the other matter a lot. But that there's this dimension that a lot of people feel very guilty and inhibited about, which is the desire to kind of let go of constraints and concern for the other and give in to your own mounting excitement. What one woman described it as, a feeling of a wave crashing on the shore, and she says, I don't want to have to worry that the shore is going to be able to take it or not. I want to just crash
beautiful
against it. And I think that's in all of us, and I see a lot of people, you probably have too, who come in worried. Here's what shuts them down. When their partner seems too worried about them, too eager to please, too sensitive to, like, is this okay? Is this okay? Do you like this? Do you not like that? Sometimes they'll say to me, they'll say, you know, Doc, sometimes I wish she or he would just throw me on the bed and fill in the blank. And when they say that, I hear them saying that they'd like it, and it's exciting, the idea that two people can engage with each other without an undue amount of empathy, which is counterintuitive in today's day and age when all sex stuff written about sex is often about how to care more about your
partner. And be more sensitive.
Yep.
There's a further factor, too, that as every child grows up, they're kind of one of the things that most children get is their mothers or fathers, usually the mothers, suggest to a child that the child has the power to hurt them.
Yeah.
So the mother will say to a child, you know, you gave me a headache, you're making me sick, you're doing this to me. And children grow up with this magical responsibility where they think they actually can hurt their parents, they can hurt their mothers. So I think that may lay in here as well, that there's at some point the partner is saying, please let this be that whatever I do with you, whatever aggression comes out of me, it's not hurting you. Let's get that off the table.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's the Rosetta Stone for understanding a lot of fantasies and desires, is just what you said, that a child grows up in an environment where one or both parents, usually it's tends to be more the mother, is communicating that if the child is too forceful, too assertive, too oppositional, too independent, too angry, that they're going to wound and hurt the mother. And if the mother's not saying it, the child's inclined to think it anyway, because kids put one and one together and equal three. When they get pissed off or angry and the mother, let's say, is depressed or absent, they kind of conclude in their childlike minds that they probably did it. And it's their responsibility. But then you add to that mothers that really do communicate that, and you have a kind of deadly combination that leaves kids with a sense that they can hurt others if they really come to their fullest self, their fullest strength.
I've seen many a man who has been with, or many people who have been with fragile mates.
Yes.
You have a husband who's sick or has, you know, something, headaches, whatever it is. And, you know, they're caretakers, and they're great caretakers, but the sexuality just goes out the window.
That's so important. That's so important because, you know, it's all couples over time, of course. There's a decline in sexual intensity, but part of it is the caring increases, but almost as if inversely, sometimes the sexual excitement decreases because there's something about the caring which can open the door to feelings that hold back your libido.
So caring in some way may, you know, recently they've been talking about oxytocin mm-hmm. and its effect on the different hormones, but there's an actual caring that in some way puts a wash over your body and makes a love be there, but it doesn't engender the fire of the passions. And I think what you're saying is one has to understand, I think you're saying you have to understand that there's kind of a thing of intimacy, the difficulty of intimacy is that you may lose your sexual intention.
Is that true? Yeah, it's very true. If you talk to sex therapists and you find out, well, what do you do to try to help a couple restore a sense of sexual vitality? You might hear 25 different strategies, depending on the person's orientation. But one of the things they're trying to do, all of them, is recreate a sense of difference, of separateness between the two. And sometimes they do it in sort of very mechanical, gamey ways. You know, I remember when I was in training, a teacher told me she used to have couples sometimes play games. You know, couples will tell me, boy, Dr. Bader, we have better sex, we go to a hotel, or somebody dresses up, or does something that restores the sense that interferes with that familiarity that I think so often can be deadening to sexual excitement.
Let's take that one for a moment, because I've certainly counseled enough men who have found that.
Yep.
The hotel is important to mostly the woman who wants the difference.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think men Well, I don't know, but I haven't heard many men talk about how boring it is because it's all the same.
You know, yeah, it's not so much that they think it's all the same, but that when a man has difficulty in a relationship he's been involved in for a while, he has trouble sometimes objectifying the woman. And objectification, I think, while it has a bad name, I think is an ingredient of most sexual fantasy life, and that sometimes what the man will feel is that he's so aware of his wife or partner's mood states and has such an ingrained obligation to make her happy, and that the more he knows about her inner states, the more he feels subtly dominated and obligated by them, and therefore he can't pull away enough to objectify her or to give in to this spaciousness that I think is important in sexual excitement.
My guest, Dr. Michael Bader, B-A-D-E-R, the name of the book, Male Sexuality. Michael, let's go a step further. You introduced a phrase, a word, pathogenic belief. Mm-hmm. What is that all about?
Well, in my way of thinking, children, all of us, healthy, neurotic, whatever, grow up, and we infer from our environments certain cause and effect relationships. We develop a set of beliefs that are often very emotionally laden that I think interfere with normal development. Let me give you, very small but very common examples. Somebody grows up and develops the belief that if they're too dependent, they're going to drain their parents and get rejected. Somebody else that if I'm too autonomous and strong, I'm going to hurt my mother. If I'm too, if I'm smarter and more effective and competent than my father, it's going to humiliate him. These are all very elementary building blocks that get in the way of the normal developmental aims that children have to grow up, to be separate, to master things, to be connected to others. And I call them pathogenic beliefs because the thing that they do in the bedroom is that these are the beliefs that, again, are very rooted in the emotions that interfere with our normal sexual arousal. I argue that if you're too worried about the other, and feel too responsible and omnipotent, you can't get aroused. I say that if you feel too rejected, you can have a pathogenic belief that I'm a defective, inferior because I'm a woman, let's say. If you feel inferior and defective, you can't get aroused. If you feel too helpless, you can't get aroused. That these are states of mind, including belief states, that regularly hold us back in the bedroom. And what's wonderful and fascinating about this is that since we still desire sexual experience and pleasure, then we creatively come up with scenarios, fantasies, preferences that enable us to get around these beliefs. So the idea of the masochist who likes to be held down or dominated is exactly the kind of thing that helps the person overcome, for that moment, the sense that they're too strong for their partner.
I suspect you have an unpopular belief about pornography.
Yes.
Or about eroticism. I won't even call it pornography, but internet eroticism.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me what you think.
Yeah, I tell you what I think about it. I think that it's an unfortunate thing in our culture that we so quickly reduce complicated issues like this into good and bad moral categories. And one of the things that we do in the process of that is we take away the complexity of the mind. You said it yourself in your introduction, that there is a tendency to flatten out our view of how people function. I'll give you an example that has to do with pornography. So child pornography, we all know, is what's called an exception to the obscenity law. That is, possessing child pornography or making it is automatically against the law. And the reason is a good one. That is that real children are hurt in the making of child pornography. And that's always been the idea behind making it illegal. Now, recently, Congress passed a law, the Supreme Court upheld it, that said, okay, it's not just child pornography where real kids are hurt. It's against the law to possess pornography where there's a computer-generated image of a child that's not a real child. So no real child's been hurt in the making of that image. And at the end of the day, it can only be that we're criminalizing someone's thinking and someone's fantasy life. And I think once we start to do that, then we're in very dangerous territory, because now we're starting to say that even if you get aroused by certain images, we're going to make that against the law under the assumption that's entirely unproven, that that makes you more likely to act on it.
That just being attracted to it makes you more likely to act on it, and acting on it would be a violation of children.
Yes.
So therefore, men have to keep it secret.
Yes.
And men must keep a lot of their fantasy secret. What about, in general, internet porn as a way that a man, you know, I've talked to enough men in their later years who say they look not to get aroused. They look to feel stimulated. They look to feel alive. It's like a curiosity, but it doesn't lead to erections and arousal, and it's going to make them want to go out and have sex. They just look because they like looking, and that keeps them in touch with the world of being in this sexual world, as opposed to just letting that part of them die.
Well, Armand, that's a perfect example of a type of man and a type of response that we're not able to understand if we have a black or white kind of rigid moral category about it. There are men, my position on it is this, that there are certainly men that are engaged in so much internet porn and looking at it that, and they are so addicted to it that it renders them incapable of having anything resembling mutual and reciprocal relationships with other real people, and it can be a huge problem in a marriage. I see a lot of couples that come in complaining of that problem, and I don't. But my interest in it is to say, well, okay, what's going on with the man? Like, why is he doing it? And oftentimes, what you see in men like this are intense feelings of loneliness and isolation, and an incredible longing for a type of relatedness which is not dominated by certain, again, my word, pathogenic beliefs in which they're, let's say, intensely responsible to make the other person happy, intensely vulnerable to rejection. Now, you can say, well, that's screwed up and neurotic, and I say, well, that's right. I think probably it affects the guy's life in lots of ways, and we should talk about it. He should get some help for that. But there are a lot of men where their enjoyment of internet porn, I would say, has a meaning to it, but the meaning doesn't mean that, therefore, it's a problem. You know, what happens is the woman will say, well, Dr. Bader, you know, I think that him using internet porn is like infidelity. It's being involved with another woman. Okay, she has a plausible reason for saying that, and I validate that, but I say, But let's listen. There's another story here. For the man, it might mean something very different. It might mean that he, like I say, that he feels intensely lonely, or he feels insecure, or he's looking for a kind of vacation from the kind of work of everyday family and social life. It doesn't mean you have to agree with it or think that that makes it okay, but let's start from the premise that it means something different to the man and to the woman.
Well, that's right. It's from that moment, we're going to have to take a short break. Mm-hmm. When we come back, we're going to continue with this, and I certainly want to talk about what happens in later life for men. This is Armand DeMille with the Positive Mind. We'll be right back. We're going to have a short break and we'll be right back.
Greetings. This is Savion Glover, and you're listening to WBAI Listener Supported Non Commercial Radio.
I'm putting
Call me in the studio right away, Armand. Immediately.
TalkBack is your gathering place for the free and fair exchange of information and ideas heard here Monday through Thursday from 3 until 5 in the afternoon. I'm Hugh Hamilton. Join me as we explore the issues and events making news across the nation and around the world with expert guests, insightful analysis, and, of course, your comments, questions, and observations. That's TalkBack right here on WBAI New York.
Because it's that song of Kiss Me a Lot, Will You? And that feeling that I think so many people have in their attempt to try to connect physically, emotionally, spiritually. Armand DeMille here with you with The Positive Mind. Dr. Michael Bader, author of Male Sexuality. Michael, just want you to mention, do you have a website, by the way?
I do. It's www, and then my name, Michael Bader, one word, michaelbader.com.
Mm-hmm. I just like being born with one word.
It is.
It's a funny thing, the way we run into each other nowadays.
Hey,
listen, so Michael, let's go back to this. We're talking about it, if you don't mind.
Sure.
People who just tuned in, we're talking about male sexuality. I have a curiosity about male sexuality. It has to do with the later years. It has to do with after 50 and kind of what happens to men between prostates and what they call, I'm not even going to go into what they call midlife crisis. The real question has to do with menopause.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when a woman goes through menopause, much changes.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not sure if what changes is pure physical, chemical, you know, she suddenly changes and her hormones are different. It makes her differently responsive and not as excited as she was.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one. Or is it an emotional thing? Is it something that happens psychologically? Because everybody is explaining it as hormonal, and they're saying just give a woman more patches and give her rubs and put chemicals on her body and rub them in and give her testosterone. You think they're missing the boat?
Well, I sure do. It's one of these things that always sort of bewilders me, which is that when we make an advance in science, we tend to then attribute everything to that. It's like somebody who makes an advance in psychology, and you're in my field, all of a sudden it's not just an advance, it has to become an entire school of thought that is independent and everything about it is right. It's absurd to think about the idea of hormones operating entirely independently of the mind, that is, of the meanings that we give to experience. For instance, a woman who's going through menopause may also be losing her children who are moving out of the house. Can you really say that, therefore, her mood state on day A is entirely a function of the fact she has less estrogen? Can you say that estrogen has a big effect? Sure you can, but it's always the case. And furthermore, we know so much more now about how psychological states can alter brain chemistry that when you look at brain chemistry changing, no one or a few people ask the question of whether or not some of that itself is facilitated by the experience of the person psychologically.
In other words, which came first, because it's simply saying that if a man in his aggression, I'm going to use aggression as an example, I think a lot of men's sexuality is tied to their ability to be aggressive.
Uh-huh.
And if a man's aggressive gets toned down, if over life, over time, he learns the less aggressive I am, the better I get along in the world.
Uh-huh.
And you find many people who may have been sexually very active become very suddenly inactive, and they become kind of laid back, and now they're more peaceful.
Well, that is certainly true, and the complexity of it, of course, and the variation is so enormous, Armand, because, of course, you also have men who are at that age. I'm 56. A lot of men or my peers are beginning to think about retirement. They're shifting their focus of themselves as an active, productive person to a more passive consumer. Now, that's not necessarily a good thing. That can be sort of render someone a little bit depressed or a little bit flat. You know, we all know about men that don't, and women that don't keep themselves active, you know, that has an effect. So how do you parse out what the effect is of our decreasing testosterone from the fact that our social role is changing to the fact that our partners are changing, our kids are gone? You know, those things all contribute to what I'm feeling at any given moment. And I think it's such a mistake to say, although it's very tempting to say, well, it's just because my testosterone is down. Because I think that also helps us with an easy out. It helps us not have to think about, is there anything else that's going on right now?
Right. I mean, it might possibly be that people in a relationship may need to make a shift and a change may be imminent. So if you could blame it on chemistry,
yep,
you kind of say, well, it's only chemistry, so we won't make any changes and we'll
that's
stick
right
along. But really, you know, somebody needs to be going to an educational conference or traveling or doing something exciting or doing something new.
It's very true. And you know, your listeners will notice probably if they think about it how many times they've seen somebody who appears to have settled for a sedentary life suddenly get engaged in something. And you know what happens is that not only do they feel better, but they look more attractive. And they feel more attractive. And that doesn't always mean they become hypersexual, but you can see how the shift in their sense of themselves immediately has repercussions in terms of their sense of being an active sexual being.
And life. You say today that men are lonelier than ever. What do you mean by that?
I think what's happened is that I think that it really was stimulated or took a big leap in the wrong direction following World War II. I think there was a tremendous movement towards a kind of a smaller nuclear family that was physically, geographically more separated from its families of origin. There was a breakdown of kinship networks that people were involved in. Sometimes they could be quite suffocating, but they also were more alive, and they kept people in contact with other people more. Fathers, initially in the 50s, because they were the primary breadwinners, were driving further away to work. Mothers were isolated in the home. You know, Betty Friedan called it the problem with no name, because the women were feeling estranged, but the culture was telling them that they ought to be happy. And there was a contradiction. And so you have a beautiful example of that in the movie Revolutionary Road. And you see some of it in the TV series Mad Men, where the women are very isolated and sort of disconnected, but the culture tells them they ought to be good housekeeping, sort of happy-go-lucky creatures, and they're not. So I think the isolation of that, and of course men anyway, Armand, as you know, and have seen it probably more than me, grow up with a sense of having to kind of make it on their own to keep their feelings to themselves. They're more emotionally cut off anyway than women. And that has an effect. It has the effect of sometimes these very strong longings that men have, that they have no place to put them. They have nothing, because they can't talk about having longings for closeness because it's shameful or it's considered weak, or they think that, you know, some humiliation involved in it. And sometimes these come out in the sexual sphere. You know, you think about someone like a, you know, Elliot Spitzer, all right, or all of these men that are being outed for seeing sex workers, prostitutes. Well, you know, what's the appeal of a prostitute? You know, there's a tremendous appeal to men who are engaged in this, at least, of seeing someone who's intensely focused on them in a time-limited way towards whom the man has no obligation. And that experience of being connected intensely on his own terms, without having to do anything more than give the woman money, is enormously appealing to those men who feel instead entrapped and burdened by this sort of obligation and responsibility most of the time.
Many of the men who I see today, Michael, come to me and they say, I know I want to be more sensitive. My wife, my mate wants me to be more sensitive. I want to become more sensitive. Mm-hmm. But I notice as I become more sensitive, I become less sexual. See, and that's on one hand. On the other hand, you hear about the man who's having a relationship outside, and on the outside he's saying, at least I have somebody who I don't have to take care of, who I can just, you know, I can be myself with, as if being myself means I'm not paying too much attention to you.
Yeah.
On that level. And I think what you're saying is kind of important, because Because men are very confused by the sensitivity issue. Most men I know are not as sensitive as the women I've met.
Right.
They can't feel the things that women feel. Mm-hmm. They don't have the senses to do it.
Mm-hmm. No, that's very true. I always feel very touched by these men that you're describing, you know, who are, so, quote, out of touch with their feelings. Because the thing about it is that they don't know how to do it, but they have this vague but often painful sense in the background that they're supposed to be doing something, and whatever it is, it's not right, or it's not enough, but they don't know what it is. And so you have these men who are feeling chronically like they're disappointing their partners, and their partners are chronically unhappy with them, but the men will say, nothing's ever good enough for her, or I don't know what she wants, or, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And so you imagine, what is that experience like? Well, the experience is like, I'm supposed to be taking care of her, and I'm supposed to be this guy that I'm not, but I don't know how to get there. And the journey seems so laden with failure that half of me doesn't even want to make the journey to try to get there.
I'm sure it works both ways for both men and women, but since we're talking about men, I can't tell you the number of men I know who have heard the cry, my wife just wants, my girlfriend just wants things to be different. She wants something unique, something special.
Mm-hmm.
So he tries to surprise her by ordering a special lunch, and she says, what makes you think I would want that? And then he says, okay, you know, I was thinking about taking pictures of you and sending them to a magazine. What makes you think that I would want that kind of thing? And he's trying anything he can to say, wait a minute, I thought you wanted something exciting and different, so I'm creating these. But what gets back to him is not that these are insufficient, but criticism for the attempt.
Right, that's right.
And that's so amazing. It's almost as if the plan is that it shouldn't work.
Uh-huh.
You know, because if it did work, someone would say, oh, thank you so much for trying it. That was such a wonderful idea. That's a really nice thought. But that's not the response they get. They usually get a response, don't you dare try anything new.
You know, it makes me smile. It's not a funny situation. It's a very tragic one. But
a painful smile.
It's very, very painful. But I had an experience about, I don't know, 7 or 8 years ago with my wife where we were at loggerheads and each feeling kind of deprived by the other. And we eventually talked about it. And what came out was something very interesting. I learned a lot from this, is that to me, if somebody loves me, I register love by what they do, not what they say. For my wife, she registers love by what I say, not necessarily by what I do. The result is that when I think I'm working overtime to please her, it's because I'm doing things for her, because that's my sense of what love means. When she thinks she's working overtime to please me, it's because she's telling me all of these sweet nothings, you know, about me. And what we realized was that we were giving to the other person the thing that we most wanted, which is not a rare case in a couple. But it goes to show you just your point that each person has the experience that they're working so hard to please the other, but they're not on the right wavelength.
There's something wrong with this whole idea of trying to please.
Mm-hmm.
Be yourself. See what happens if you could be yourself and see how it takes the other person. You know, sometimes I think the partner would rather have you just be yourself and do what's good for you rather than try to please them, because they may just come from a place where nothing's going to please them anyway and they don't want to get you sucked into it. They'd rather have somebody around who's going to hold their own, you know? Who's going
to
say?
Well, that's a good point. That's a good point. That gets to that sense of wanting your partner to be strong and a person in their own right, and not be bending over backwards to placate and make you happy. And also, some people pick the idea that someone's trying hard as meaning that they're hard to please. It's not a gift for you to try hard to please me. It's like I want to say, why do you have to try so hard? You know, what is it about pleasing me? Is it the worst thing in the world? Is it something like cleaning the stables? Is it jumping through fiery hoops? What is it? So I think you're absolutely right that sometimes the person just really wants the other person, the partner, to just be themselves and be strong enough to have their own life and not be running around in circles trying to make me laugh.
Well, it brings us to a very important conclusion. It brings us to a transition right here, Michael. Uh-huh. Michael Bader, by the way, Male Sexuality, the name of the book. It is so hard. I mean, if as a psychotherapist, as somebody who counsels people, I've seen so many people say, if only I could find somebody who could be themselves. What women are looking for in men are men who have a sense of self. And what uh-huh. men want with women is women who have a sense of self. And somehow we believe that the negotiation of a relationship is relinquishing the self to moving away from your real self to some other self that is more pleasing to the other person.
That's an interesting way to put it, Armand, actually.
Because it just sounds like what you really want is your man to be himself and your woman to be herself. Just be yourself and I'll be myself. And I think that has a stronger magnet than just getting the different hotel rooms and trying to, you know, bring new toys and do new things. I mean, just be yourself. Be please yourself. Go out on your own time. You know, don't stick around me if I'm not fun.
Right.
Take care of yourself and let's see how things work.
And what's so profound about that actually is that if you think about us growing up, one of the things that most often happens that creates difficulty, as most people know, is when a child develops a false self in order to attempt to please and connect with a parent that he or she feels can't really accept and see them for who they are. And even though that sounds simplistic, it's exactly what you're talking about, the idea that I'm supposed to be somebody else and work real hard at it to connect with you reinforces the idea that it's not okay if I'm just me.
You know, I've heard many men talk about when their mates go on holiday or vacation, and they talk about how, well, now it's free during that, and women too, I've heard of this, when they're alone in the house, and they talk about how they get a sense of themselves that they forgot about. You know, and let's say, you know, your wife goes away with the kids for a couple of weeks and you're there alone. Uh-huh. And you get a sense of there's a me here. There's a me here that doesn't have to pick up my clothing or a me here that wants to pick up my clothing. Uh-huh. But it's a me. It's uh-huh. I'm here. I exist. I think this is such an essential part of people. Men and women. That if anything we could allow, if maybe for the first time in your life, somewhere a person becomes who they really are as opposed to dancing through hoops for the rest of the world.
Mm-hmm. It's easy to see how when you grow up in a family where you're utterly dependent on your parents to define what's real, the way things are supposed to be for your security, your protection, for everything, that their importance in your mind and your need to figure out who they are, what they want, what they need and what they don't like is such a life or death, a necessity, and we are so primed and able to do that as human beings, as babies, as children. We're so good at doing that, that we become so attuned to the other person by virtue of our dependence on them, that when we grow up and individuate and become our own people, we still have some of that heritage of trying to read the other person with a very fine tooth comb, a very finely attuned instrument, and that can sort of supplant our listening to our own voice.
Well, it sounds like you've done some valuable work. Do you run men's groups? Just curiously.
I haven't run men's groups. I haven't done groups in quite a while. I mainly am seeing couples and individuals. And after my first book, I came out with a book in 2002 called Arousal, The Secret Logic of Sexual Fantasies. And after that book came out, I had a lot of men consult with me, or a lot of women insist their men consult with me. And I started seeing all of these men and realizing that as much as they were each, of course, unique and completely particular who they were also similar in certain ways. The sort of sense of loneliness, the feeling of feeling obliged and burdened was enough similar that I thought it was worth writing another book.
Beautiful. Our work is similar. We'll have to talk again. I think we're going to do more programming. I run groups with men. I mean, just to see them together and making that bond and being able to share with each other what they feel is amazing.
That's great.
Yeah. So the name, Dr. Michael Bader, the name of the book, Male Sexuality. This is Armand DeMille with you at The Positive Mind here on WBAI 99.5 FM on your dial. We'll be back with you soon, my friends. And if you want to get a copy of today's program, you could go to thepositivemind.com or to WBAI.org where you can restream it. Thanks a lot, Michael, for being with us.
Thank you very much, Armand.
Sure.